Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Okay, folks, welcome into another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. Bill Bartholomew here with you. Hopefully you had a spectacular holiday weekend in spite of the weather here in southern New England. Today, we're picking up on a story that I was tweeting about early Saturday morning that obviously became a national story, and that is the encounter between Massachusetts State Police and members of the group Rise of the Moors in Wakefield, Massachusetts. We welcome in a familiar voice on this platform, Raymond Two Hawks Watson, CEO and founder of the Providence Cultural Equity Initiative. And I have been following, loosely anyway, the Rise of the Moors through Ray's work on social media and some of the exchanges that I've seen him have with defenders of the group, perhaps members of the group. And it's fascinating to hear Ray's position on this, his analysis. I think he offers perspective that nobody else can provide in terms of who this group is and how we got to the point where this standoff occurred in Massachusetts over the weekend. And also fascinating, you'll hear coming up in the episode, that Ray, along with a few other people, met with local law enforcement trying to bring attention to them of the Moorish nationalism that was taking place inside of this group. Number one, to prevent what we saw this past weekend, but also to create an ability for them to distinguish between people who simply have a Moorish identity, and then even more broadly, those who are indigenous, so on and so forth. So a fascinating, important conversation with Raymond Two Hawks Watson here on the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm going to play you right now a clip from WPRI Channel 12, the latest on this investigation from their perspective. Then we'll come back and get into the conversation with Ray Watson.
According to state police, the group referred to themselves as a militia and stated that they adhere to, quote, Moorish sovereign ideology. They were found in military fatigues and heavily armed with 8 military-style weapons when they were arrested Saturday morning following an hours-long standoff with police that shut down part of Route 95 near Boston and triggered a shelter-in-place for Wakefield and Reading residents.
So again, Ray had conversations with Jamal Tavon Sanders-Latimer in the past, and you'll hear his description of his impressions, I should say, of Mr. Latimer from the past. Jamal, one of the leaders of this group and someone who was among the 11 arrested in Massachusetts on Saturday morning. Okay, let's get to it. Raymond Two Hawks Watson here on B-Town discussing the events that took place in Massachusetts over the weekend. All right, so Raymond Two Hawks Watson, no stranger to these airwaves. Welcome back for, I don't know, third or fourth time, sir.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity once again, Bill. Always great coming on the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
So, you know, okay, so let's just cut to the chase here. So over the weekend, you know, a lot of us woke up to the news that there was this standoff happening in Wakefield, Massachusetts. The Massachusetts State Police were kind of putting out vague press releases as to who was involved. But then at the same time, people started sending me live streams that were happening on YouTube. And quickly, I started to connect the dots that this was the Rise of the Moors group based in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which I was vaguely familiar with at one point, but mostly familiar with because I had seen your interactions on social media and so on and so forth with this group. So no better person, no one more qualified to assess this and provide analysis than you on the matter. So let's get right into it. Your impression when you got the news on I guess it was Saturday morning that this standoff was happening in Massachusetts.
Sure. So my initial thoughts, and this goes back to what you mentioned, Bill, the quote unquote leader of the group Rise of the Moors, Jamal, he's actually related to the Latimer family, which is a pretty sizable family here in Rhode Island. So, you know, his father grew up with my mother and aunts, you know, so there was like a sort of like a relationship there. I didn't know the gentleman personally, but somewhat of a relationship there just because of the Rhode Island sort of way, you know, family members, no family members. So I had become aware of him maybe about 4 years ago, because I had heard that he was making certain legal claims that, from my understanding, working with the local tribes, those are claims that only tribes should be involved in or kind of moving forward. So I proactively reached out to him, ended up connecting with him, and then actually invited the brother to come and meet with some of the local chiefs from the local tribes, just to kind of, you know who the local Indians are. And then to give some feedback on where his perspectives were off a little bit, particularly from a historical standpoint. Basically, what his argument is that Moors were in the lands that we now call the Americas prior to Europeans, which I don't necessarily have an issue with that. You know, there's a lot of history out there that just been misfed to people. Columbus discovered the Americas right there. That should tell you something, you know. And when you get into it, there were actually Moors on the ship with Columbus when he came over. So, and then the question becomes, well, if the Moors are piloting the ships, then clearly they must have known in some form or fashion where they were going or how to get there. So it opens up this whole other conversation around what the real history was with interaction in these lands prior to Columbus. And of course, we know that Vikings and things of that nature came over here in the 8th and 9th centuries. So just the notion that these lands were unknown until Columbus came over, this is just very questionable. So I'm willing to give credence to that claim of theirs because I'm open to learning because I don't know of everything. Where it gets outrageous is when they go beyond that and then claim that these lands were under some great Moroccan empire. And that, of course, means that my people were underneath some great Moroccan empire here in our own lands. So that's where the conflict came in immediately right there because I'm like, well, that's just not historically true. And that's not what my people's oral history says. So that's where he and I were having conflict. So I brought him before the chiefs. We kind of explained everything. And then I just lost track of him for a while after that. Next thing I know, he popped up in the capacity that he's in now. You know, a Moorish national who, if I understand the ideology correctly, because of the Treaty of Peace and Friendship between Morocco and the U.S. in the 1700s or 1800s or whenever that is, they somehow now take that to mean that they're not under state jurisdiction and that they can be a separate nation here in the U.S. but superior to the states. That is outrageous. Like for anyone who's been in law school or no, it's just absolutely outrageous. So to answer your question, brother, when I heard the information on Saturday, my immediate thought was, I told you this is what was going to happen. I told you you were going to run afoul of law enforcement, and I told you you were going to wind up locked up in jail. And that's what happened on Saturday going into, or Friday going into Saturday. So that was my initial thoughts, Bill. I told this brother, and he didn't listen.
How many people outside of those who are the two Rhode Islanders and the other nine who were caught up in this in Massachusetts, to your knowledge, how many, what is the total membership of this group here in Rhode Island?
So I can't say total membership. And it's really interesting because from my understanding, there's actually at least two different distinct sets of Moors. I refer to one group as Moorish Americans. And those are the ones that I think are fantastic members of the community. They're civically engaged. They're trying to do things in the community that are positive, trying to be inspirational. They just identify as Moors. And to me, that's beautiful because people identify as Italian, people identify as Irish, people like, you know, Cape Verdean, but they're all Americans, you know. So I've got no issue with that. And actually, once again, I don't know everything. So I was like, oh, wow, you know, I didn't know much about Moorish heritage or anything like that. I'd love to learn more. So that group is fantastic. And I know some excellent individuals in the city, in the state, who identify as Moorish Americans. This particular group, I differentiate them by calling them Moorish nationals, because a Moorish national, of course, a national of another nation. So those are the ones that are getting into trouble. And I think the real issue is that there's a real blurred line because you get some people that identify with Moorish Americans, but then they get fed, I call it sovereign citizen rhetoric from Moorish nationals. And then they start to make the connections between a Moorish heritage and then these claims that are being made. And that's where all the trouble comes in. So personally, I couldn't put an exact number on who's in the Moorish national sort of movement. I know that there's a good deal of Moorish Americans out here. And one of my main concerns is that law enforcement, because of what's going on with these Moorish nationals, is going to take and start to impose that upon the Moorish American community here. Now, beyond that, and this is, I'd like to talk a little bit about this as well, but I'll stop my thoughts after this. I'm personally concerned with our local political leadership. I'll start with Governor Raimondo when she was in. And then I'll speak specifically to the Providence Police Department leadership, because we have been pushing the issue with this particular group and this particular individual for several years, specifically since 2019, when myself, Eugene Montero, Dr. Taino Palermo went and met with leadership from the Providence Police Department because they had had a run-in with this particular individual and his group. And the conversation we had with them was, this is a public safety concern. The tribes have been keeping an eye on this gentleman and his group for a while. In our opinion, the best strategy would be for you all to start to work with us so that we can collectively get our arms around this, so that you don't start mistaking people for something that they're not, and so that you don't create a public safety concern for other citizens of Rhode Island and otherwise. And we were told, yeah, we're going to move forward on this. We're going to be proactive, and then no follow up. And here we are 2 years later with an armed standoff in Massachusetts. So, yeah, I can't say for certain, Bill, but it's big enough to be an issue at this point, and it's only growing. And to our political leadership, I say, once again, I told you so. And now you've gotten your own colleagues in Massachusetts in a situation because you refuse to do anything here.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you basically put forth the notion that this was likely to happen or something of this nature, and no response whatsoever.
Now, I'll say this. That's not all law enforcement. I mentioned those two because we've gone around and spoken to a lot of law enforcement, and this is why I put it back on our political leadership. The general conversation we've gotten from all of them is, we get it, but we can't do anything until we hear something from the political leadership. And when we tried to reach out to the Raimondo administration about this, we were continuously just ignored. Ignored, pretended like we don't exist. And what our issue was, taking it out of the Moorish perspective, as American Indians here in the Northeast, from just a looks perspective, we look like these people. So if you don't know anything about culture, if you don't know anything about history, if you just look at, oh, those are black people, well, now my own people become a concern for me, because if law enforcement once again doesn't know any of the difference, and then they bump into one of my people, one of my people starts to speak something that sounds similar to like what these Moorish, they're going to get treated like a Moorish national. And you know me, Bill, that means I got to go, you know, and I don't like to go there. I don't like going off. I don't like, you know, I don't want to do that, but I will if our rights are being violated. So that was initially how we kind of approach the situation. We don't want our people getting mixed up in this because law enforcement doesn't know any better. So please, let's build around this. And once again, law enforcement couldn't really get any go-ahead from the political leadership. So here we are with now law enforcement in Massachusetts being in jeopardy pretty much.
The reaction to this has been really interesting to watch. First of all, when it first the story first broke, one of the in fact, that the someone who's, I think, a tech person behind the scenes at Uprise posted, replied to my tweet. Oh, I know what color skin these people have because they're still alive. So there was immediately injected that this is a white right wing militia. And then at the same time, you heard conservative folks say, well, this is a violation of constitutional rights with respect to bearing arms or transporting arms. And it just kind of both extremes of our political and social culture are seemingly off on this one. What's your reaction to those types of statements?
So I think that, and personally, Bill, you know, life is about balance. So I'm always consistently trying to find that space in the middle where the actual truth is. And both of those perspectives show extreme views of what took place there. What happened was, they were parked on the side of the road at night with hazard lights on, putting gas in their tank. Why wouldn't a police officer seeing that have probable cause to pull over and see what's going on? Imagine that's you and you're stuck in your car on the side of the road with hazards in need of some assistance, and an officer just rides by you because, yeah. Well, I don't know. And so the notion that the officer shouldn't have stopped is outrageous. All right. The officer gets there. He pulls up to see what's going on. From what I understand, a bunch of gentlemen hop out of the cars and camouflage with weapons. What do you expect the officer to do at this point? You know what I'm saying? So the officer engages further. What's going on here? Oh, well, we're going off to Maine. We're going to train. Okay, if I'm the officer, I know nothing about this situation. Let me see if I can find out who I'm dealing with. So, all right, do you have any identification? No. So right there, like, I don't know. Someone's got to explain to me where constitutional rights would allow you to tell an officer, after he sees you with hazard lights on the side of a road in the middle of the night, hopping out the car and camouflage with weapons, talking about you're going to Maine to private property to train, to not find out who you are, especially if you have guns on you, right? Because here's the thing. Under federal and state law, if you have certain convictions, you can't have a gun. So the officer has to, in order to do his job, check to see and make sure if anyone there has a gun that shouldn't. Now, the issue would come in if the officer did that checking, everyone checked out, there was no issues, and then he kept up. Now you've got a problem.
Yep.
Now we can talk about the constitutional rights violation. Now we can discuss all of that. But until that point, that's not even a valid conversation to have. Now, let's add on to that, Bill. After refusing to identify yourselves, it gets to a certain point, you all just run off into the woods with guns and camouflage. And I'm the only officer out here? You're out your mind. I'm calling for all the backup in the world because I can't see you in the woods. How do I know you don't just start shooting at me from the woods? And So the officer called backup. That's what the whole issue was. It had nothing to do, in my opinion. This is my opinion. I'm not even a lawyer yet, but had nothing to do with race, had nothing to do with guns. It's about an officer seeing someone who seems to be in an emergency situation, doing what an officer is supposed to do, and 11 people in camouflage hop out with guns, talking about they're from another nation, and they're going to train. I don't understand what people are talking about. And my thing is this. I don't care what your skin tone is. I don't care what your ideology is. I don't trust people I don't know claiming to be from some nation I don't know with guns saying they're going to train on private property that I know nothing about. Yeah. I don't trust that. I don't know about anyone else. I don't trust that. And for all of the complaining we do about law enforcement and that they should do their job correctly, to me, this was law enforcement doing their job correctly. So I don't got no issues with the police in this. I personally don't see any legal issues. And like I said, I told you all. I told all of the people that I was getting into it with Jamal over the years, this is where you're going to end up at if you keep this up, because what you're doing isn't legal. That's my thoughts on it, Bill, brother.
If you enjoy the independent journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that Bartholomew Town provides, consider a one-time donation via Venmo at Bill Bartholomew or paypal.me/Bill Bartholomew, or for as little as $3 per month, become a sustaining supporter by visiting patreon.com/Bartholomewtown. One last question on this, because you really are the authority here. The media coverage of this, I haven't really watched a whole lot of TV on this. It's over holiday weekend, you know what I mean, et cetera. But do you get the sense that by and large, Rhode Islanders, people around the country are being given information that will help them to understand what's happening, or is this being overly simplified from what you've observed?
I think the media is doing what the media does, which is why I enjoy working with individuals like you, Bill, because you actually try to do some journalism, you know, and you try to get to some facts, and media is doing what media does. I think the problem that I've seen is that even the individuals who, from a law enforcement perspective, are being touted as kind of the experts on this, don't got it right. They don't know what they're talking about, because ultimately what this comes down to, Bill, and this is where my companies and my focus has been, this it comes down to differences between culture and ethnicity and heritage. And most of these people are only dealing through a racial lens. So these are black identity extremists. No, these are Moors. And if you speak to Moors, they'll tell you, don't call me black. I'm a Moor. So what you have is the media, in my opinion, doing what the media does, but coming from a lack of understanding. So kind of patching in the holes with what they think will fit and it not really fitting. And once again, I will reiterate, and I'm really encouraging the Rhode Island public to put some pressure on the politicians so that the law enforcement can do what we've been asking. Why haven't they been proactive on this bill? We submitted a bill in 2018 to the judiciary to address issues of jurisdiction, because ultimately what this group is arguing is a jurisdictional issue. So our issue was, well, state, sit down and let's work this out with the tribes. So when anyone brings up jurisdiction, you already know what the policy is. And if you listen to what these Rise of the Moor individuals are arguing, they're arguing that they are indigenous aboriginal inhabitants to the lands, and therefore they're not under jurisdiction. Now, that language provides a bit of an issue for law enforcement because there are limitations and restrictions. However, those limitations and restrictions are going to be with the specific tribes that are from the lands that are in question. But if you don't know that, if you don't have any relationship with the tribes, and then you get a bunch of yahoos coming out of nowhere utilizing the same language, if I'm law enforcement, I do this for a second because I don't know. I don't know if I'm actually violating some right. I don't want to get any action against me. So I might pause for a moment. And in that pause could be where I get shot, could be where I get nervous and shoot someone. Could be where I let someone go that I shouldn't have let go, or could be where I lock someone up that I shouldn't have locked up. All of it leads to just a situation that no one wants. So the tribes, and I can speak on behalf of the local tribes, we're saying to our Rhode Island neighbors, what's up with your political leadership out here? We've been pushing this issue for 4 or 5 years now and been being ignored. Look what's happening to your public safety. Why aren't you telling them they should be working with us so that when you get people out of the blue claiming to be indigenous, claiming to be aboriginal, law enforcement can reach out to one of the local tribes and say, hey, this guy popped up. He's saying this. What do you know about it? He's not with us. You all should deal with him like you would anyone else. Okay, no problem. And that's the relationship we've been trying to push. And I'll also share this as well, Bill. This Rise of the Moor group, it's not the only group like this in Rhode Island. We had to check a gentleman up in the Cumberland area talking about that Rhode Island was ancestral Cherokee territories. You notice I had to call him, what do you mean Rhode Island's Cherokee territories? There's Nipmucks, there's Narragansett, you know. So we try to be proactive in addressing these issues on our own. And then we've been trying to do our own due diligence of passing this information along to law enforcement. But it's just been this sort of thing where law enforcement is like, we get it and we appreciate it, but we have to follow what the state laws and policy are. And until the political leadership says something different, this is the way we have to go. So in that note, I want to, you know, I want to give much respects to retired Colonel Stephen O'Donnell, who was proactive with us in these regards. I want to give, you know, respect to Chief Sullivan from the Rhode Island Police Chiefs Association. We've been in consistent communication with him through Eugene Montero. We actually met with, is it Sid? I forget the chief's name, but he's the head of the Police Chiefs Association. Yeah. We also had a conversation with them. So I want to give them respect for taking the time, sitting and listening to us, you know, having some good dialogue. But at the end of the day, like the same thing with Leo Bohr, right? It's up to the politicians. It's up to the political leadership to change it. And that's really where the situation is. And I will tie it to that in the same fashion that the political leadership has done nothing about Leo Bohr, which has continually created a public safety concern within the black and brown communities. The political leadership's lack of initiative and lack of leadership on this Moorish national issue and on building relationships with the tribes is now creating a public safety concern for Rhode Islanders in general and now in Massachusetts. So Rhode Island neighbors, please, what's going on with the politicians out here? And I'll also be bold enough to put a plea out to our current governor and our current lieutenant governor. The tribes are here. We're aware that these are issues. We have certain knowledges and certain relationships that the state doesn't have, that law enforcement doesn't have, but that are most certainly beneficial to public safety of everyone. Work with us. Stop ducking us. Stop ignoring us. This problem isn't going away. It's growing. And the more you try to ignore it, the more you try to pretend like it's not here. Because the way that Jamal conducted himself, you know, I don't have any issues with the brother. When I met with him, I found him to be quite intelligent, quite articulate. I thought he had great leadership qualities. What happens if you bump into someone calling themselves a Moor who doesn't think that they're under state or federal jurisdiction, who doesn't have those qualities and has guns on them?
Yep.
What happens then? Is someone laying out on the floor dead because politicians would rather not work with the Indian tribe? What is the outcome to this? Because it's already gone as far as we said it would. And I can very much see sometime in the near future going beyond what it did right now. So do we sit on our hands and keep pretending like the Indians aren't around, state of Rhode Island? Or do we proactively do something about this to make sure that everyone is protected? Indians, Rhode Islanders, Moorish Americans, black and brown, whoever, make sure everyone's safety is protected.
Raymond Two Hawks Watson, Providence Cultural Equity Initiative CEO and founder, the authority on this topic, that's for sure right now. And thanks for hopping on. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Bill. As always, appreciate the time. And, just happy to get the word out there. Much respect to all of the people out there trying to do positive things in the community. Much respect to my brother Joel from the local Moorish American communities. Much respect to law enforcement that sees and is trying to build. Much respect to everyone who's just trying to do the right thing. And all sorts of aggressiveness and anger towards those who aren't. So yeah. As always, Bill, thank you for your time, brother.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.